I think the amount of hops you can handle is a point of pride if you're a hipster. Welcome to Hello PhD, the podcast for scientists and the people who love them. On today's show, we look at a new labor law that could boost postdoc pay, and we answer your questions about getting help in your rotation lab and how to land the industry job you've always wanted. Stick around.
So we're back. This is episode 2, and I'm Joshua Hall, and
I'm Daniel Arneman,
and we're here to talk to you guys about lab, science culture, and really peel back the layer on working in the research world. So what are we going to talk about today, Dan?
Well, the first part is to talk about some ethanol.
I like the sound of that.
Yeah.
What are we drinking today?
This is really a classic to me. This is Dale's Pale Ale, and we thought originally that it was just a North Carolina beer, but it turns out it's also brewed in Colorado.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
I always claimed it as one of our local brews.
Well, I mean, it doesn't mean it's not one of our local brews. It just means it's also one of Colorado's local brews.
Okay.
So we've got 6.5% alcohol and 65 international bittering units.
International bittering units.
Is that a coincidence?
I wonder. We should ask.
We should ask. I really like Dale's Pale Ale. It's kind of a go-to beer. It was on sale this week, so also a favorite if you're trying to save a little cash.
The price is right.
It comes in a can, which I think is a nice feature. And I think this is, if you are trying to be a hipster, this is a great entry point. So you may not be ready for a full 200 IBU IPA, but you get a can of Dale's Pale Ale.
So is that a hipster thing? So your a hipster rite of passage is the amount of IBU that you can tolerate?
I think the amount of hops you can handle is a point of pride if you're a hipster.
And then how do you factor that into the PBR consumption of the hipster, which is a very low IBU?
But a high can content.
That's true. The can is key. The can's coming back. I've seen more and more local brews bringing the can. I like the can, actually.
Yeah. So here's what you do. Maybe you're not ready for a full IPA. You get yourself a Dale's Pale Ale. You
65, middle of the road.
65, middle of the road. You grow a beard. You get a nice button-down shirt. You start listening to music no one's ever heard of.
Okay, so I'm starting to get a little self-conscious.
Okay, sorry about that, yeah.
I know you guys can't see me, but he's basically describing what I look at. I just want to say, just to defend myself here, not that there's anything wrong with being a hipster, but I have, in fact,
anything wrong with that.
I have, in fact, worn flannel and been bearded in at least maybe 3 different decades now since high school. I have pictures of me.
But that was the grunge era, and then I don't know what the other era was.
You know, I'm actually hearing myself talk, and I'm realizing what I'm actually saying here is I was a hipster before it was cool.
Oh my gosh. This just went to a whole new level of hipster meta.
Guilty as charged. But I will say the Dale's is ice cold and delicious right
now. Try it out. Get started on your hipster path. You will enjoy it.
Yes. So, science.
Science.
What's in the news right now?
You tell me.
Well, so one thing I found interesting, this is something that's been going around some of the circles that I run in, is a new proposed regulation by Barack Obama.
And who is that again?
I believe he would be the president, current sitting president of the United States.
Not familiar, I'm sorry.
But this is interesting because this new labor law potentially would provide extra income for people who make under $50,400 per year. And this has to do with individuals who are working overtime beyond a 40-hour week. So this is interesting to us because for those of us who have been or are or know a postdoc.
Oh, that sounds relevant.
One thing I know about postdocs and having been a postdoc, 2 key things. One, certainly working over a 40-hour week is something a postdoc might be inclined to do. And last I checked, postdocs were typically making under $50,400 a year.
Yeah, so the standard fellowship stipend, and I think this is dictated by the NIH, but it's $42,840. So you can be expected to start around there, although I believe people start lower and sometimes they start higher. There's probably some range around that level.
Yeah, I've always thought of that $42,000 or whatever the NIH minimum at least in certain fields, tends to be the pretty standard starting postdoc.
But what we know is it's in that range.
Yes.
A lot of people are making less than that 50,400 mark. And, I mean, I don't ever recall thinking twice about going in on a Saturday or a Sunday when I needed to split cells or I needed to autoclave some media or I needed to take care of the mice. But I never thought to myself, oh, I should be getting time and a half for these hours that I'm spending overtime.
Yeah, and the thought would be if this new regulation went into effect and counted for postdocs, this actually would give postdocs the ability to get time and a half pay for time over 40 hours per week.
Obama!
So, I don't know. What do you think about this? This fundamentally could change a lot as far as how postdocs are compensated. Usually postdocs are kind of in this no man's land of employment for the university.
It's the purgatory of your career.
It really is, because as a graduate student, you usually have the benefits and perks of being a student at a university. And then as a full employee, like as a technician or a faculty member or a research associate, you get all the benefits of being an employee. But as a postdoc, really, you're like a temporary worker is usually your classification. You get no benefits, really, to speak of. So
no, that's right. And I've worked on both sides of that divide. So I worked for a university, but not as a scientist. Well, I guess as a scientist, but not that kind of scientist. And there's this very important distinction that they make between people who are protected by the Personnel Act, and this is just maybe in our state, and those people who aren't protected. And certain rules apply to scientists, and other rules apply to people like administrative staff and to, I guess, some of the support people that, mm-hmm. that work at the university. And in this state, that line is very distinct. I don't know if that's true everywhere, but I don't think it's going to be such an easy home run that postdocs are just going to start making more money.
Yeah, I think it's hard to say, and this is certainly, at least in my mind, this is something that snuck up on us a little bit. I feel like this kind of came about a little bit quietly, and I'm in the university setting, and I feel like people just start talking about this. My understanding is the Labor Department is actually seeking comments on this proposal for the next 2 months and are actually encouraging people to weigh in. And so one thing we would encourage anyone listening, especially if you are a postdoc and you have a dog in this fight, is you should go in and advocate for yourself.
That's right, yeah. Don't miss out on the chance. If somebody asks you for your opinion on how much you should be making as a postdoc,
If you are a postdoc who hopes to be a faculty member in the next 2 years and you're thinking, I don't want to pay my lousy postdoc time and a half for overtime, maybe you go in on the other side of that.
Well, I really don't think that it would be the case where somebody would pay time and a half for overtime. I think what they would do is to boost postdoc pay over the 50,400 mark, and then they don't have to worry about it. I've never seen a postdoc fill out a time card. I just can't see it happening.
Yeah, I don't think that would be realistic. I think you're right. Well, maybe what this could lead to, if postdocs are included, would be very quickly, at least at the, whether it's at the federal level or the institution level or at the individual PI level, instantly boosting postdoc pay over that federal minimum for this regulation.
Yeah, and so what does that do to a grant? Does that mean fewer dollars can go to the tissue culture facility and fewer dollars can go to the mouse facility?
Well, that is one of the, I guess that's one of the thoughts against this for people who are falling the side of being against this applying to postdocs is, well, what if this really just leads to the firing of postdocs or more resistance to hiring postdocs in the first place if they're going to cost more money?
It's already a competitive field. It's not as if there are these open postdoc positions that they just take years to fill. I mean, people are lined up to get these roles. So, you know, if there are fewer of them, it just means it gets harder, right?
Yeah, I mean, my understanding, you know, knowing a lot of colleagues who have gone through this path, having gone through this path myself, is I don't really see or hear about a lot of people who are struggling to get a postdoc. So on one hand...
So maybe it's not as competitive as it seems?
Well, I'm not sure. There's a couple things going on that I can think about. on one hand, if we think about graduate students versus postdocs, so at most of the large research institutions, at least in the United States, the major workforce are grad students and postdocs. And if we think about the cost of each of these groups, you know, a postdoc right now, you've got the $42,000 to $50,000 salary and some insurance, and that's about it. If you think about a graduate student salaries have been ticking up and up and up, and postdoc salaries have been pretty flat over the last 10 years.
Why would a graduate student salary go up and a postdoc wouldn't? You'd think the postdoc would be a more valuable employee.
Well,
they're already
and trained. That's what's interesting. There seems to be more competition at the institutional levels
I see.
For graduate students. And so one thing that you start to see are that institutions and graduate programs are actually competing with one another for the best graduate students. And one of the ways they're doing this is there's an arms race for stipends offered. So you don't want to be the university who's lagging behind several thousand dollars behind your competitors and the stipends they are offering. And so what's happening is NIH actually has a minimum graduate student stipend as well that tends to be far below what a lot of universities are paying. And the universities are footing the bill, or at least enforcing their own minimum to keep up with their competitor universities to attract the best graduate students.
You're telling me I should apply to grad school again.
Maybe so. I mean, a lot of schools now, at least in the biomedical sciences, are around $30,000 or even more for a graduate student, whereas postdocs are still hanging out in the low 40s as a starting salary. And so one thing as a faculty member you have to think about, especially as grant funds get tighter, a graduate student has that stipend and insurance as well, but a grad student is also a student, and so they carry with them a tuition bill. And so you start to see that the cost of a grad student, cost of a postdoc starts to get pretty similar.
Well, and the work output is often different. So not only are the costs different, but also the amount that you're getting out of a postdoc is more. I mean, you're doing less in terms of training. You're doing less in terms of time. They're not out of the lab for 2 years while they take classes. So it seems like it's time for an increase. I looked at one figure that said the $42,000 or $45,000 recommended by the NIH in 2001 actually equates to about $60,000 today. I mean, a $42,000 salary today, I mean, is it livable? Can you make that work? Especially if you have kids and a family, which a lot of postdocs do.
Well, I think that's a real challenge that a lot of postdocs go through, whether it's a practical challenge or just a psychological challenge. You know, you've gone through this amount of training, you've got your degree, you know, you find yourself to be more educated and trained than the vast majority of the population, and yet, you know, you look around at your peers who may have gone into the workforce right after graduation, and now it's 6 or 7 years later, and, you know, you're still earning in the low 40s, that can be frustrating.
Should have gotten that MBA.
There you go.
You pop out and you make 100 grand.
There you go. Maybe. I don't know about that.
No. You wouldn't be in the lab if you didn't love it. So obviously there are some other benefits that you're getting from working in that environment. But it is true. You are the best trained or the most educated person in your peer group, but that does not translate to more dollars, especially right out of school. And I think there's a lot of unperceived losses in that time value of money. So if you start investing when you're 22 years old because you get a job at $30,000 and you start putting money down in your IRA or in a bank account, that compounds. And those years matter. You come out of grad school when you're 28, you go into a postdoc and are still not making enough to start saving for retirement. By the time you're 35 or 36, you've lost a lot of time.
No, that's true. And I think, you know, a lot of these factors, and if you look at the history of postdoc salaries over the last decade, it's time for an increase. It just looks like this could be a very roundabout way of postdocs actually finally getting that
I think
bump.
That's right. This is a conversation starter. Even if this bill or this law is not that thing that changes it, it's been coming. It's been kind of massing over time. And I think it's a conversation that will be had, and maybe this is the venue for it to happen. Who knows?
Yeah, and so along those lines, if you are a postdoc and you're listening to this, we'd love to hear from you. If you have some opinions on just your ability to live on the postdoc salary, what that experience is like, or just your thoughts on postdoc pay, we would love to hear about it.
Yep. Tweet to us at HelloPhD. You can email us at podcast@HelloPhD.com. And also go to the website. We'll post it on our show notes for today, and you can go and register your opinion on the government website.
Yeah, we'll make sure we put that on there so you can make your voice heard. Okay, so now this is the part of the show where we are going to take some listener questions having to do with anything related to life in the lab experience, the research culture, or careers. So, Dan, what kind of questions do we have coming in this week?
Okay, so the first one comes from Bill, and he's at a very familiar place in his training. He says, I'm doing a rotation in a fairly well-known micro lab, and the PI isn't around much. I'm working under a postdoc, and he's really busy. Every time I ask for help, he tells me he'll help me later, and I've lost a couple of weeks waiting on him. What should I do? This is near and dear to my heart, but do you have some advice for him?
That's a really frustrating situation. I can imagine Bill's pretty stressed, especially if this happens to be his first rotation in graduate school.
We talked last week about going to a big lab or a small lab, and I had an experience in a larger, more well-established lab where I had the same experience. I had this postdoc, and he was busy, and the PI was busy, and everybody was busy, and I needed to learn these techniques. It was a microscopy lab that you can't sit down on these, $40,000, $50,000, $100,000 microscopes and just figure it out. You need somebody to show you, and I had the same experience. I didn't end up doing well in that rotation because of it, so I'm hoping you have some advice for me and Bill.
Yeah, so I can identify a little bit with this. So, my background, I actually went to a smaller liberal arts school for my undergraduate training. And so my research experience there in a much smaller environment was that there was lots of support available to me. And so in some ways, there was a little bit of a culture shock going from a small university to a large research university for my PhD. And I think a lot of students encounter that going from a small school to a big research school. Because people
and is that common for the PI to kind of pass off the graduate students to a postdoc?
Yes, I would say that is the most typical situation, unless you are in a brand new lab with a brand new PI. We talked a little bit about that last week. I think in most cases, working with a more established tenured PI, an associate professor, full professor especially, you can expect as a rotation student to be paired with a senior person in the lab, whether that's a postdoc, maybe a grad student.
Or I've had technicians that knew more than the PI about what's going on, and I've had really great experiences there.
I would say the typical situation is the PI is not the most knowledgeable person on a day-to-day basis that you should go
Makes
to.
Sense. Makes sense, yeah. Keep that in mind, graduate students.
Yeah, and I've actually had students who are new to training that are actually a little bit concerned because they say, well, I thought I was going to work with the PI, and I'm working with a postdoc or grad student. Well, that's okay. I mean, just because someone's a postdoc or grad student, they can be extremely helpful and some of the most helpful people in your training. But it sounds like Bill is having the opposite problem. He's been paired with someone. He's new to this lab. He's trying to get his feet under him. And the postdoc he's been paired with is completely unavailable or is actually just unwilling to be a mentor and to spend time doing what that takes.
The reality is not everybody is nurturing, right? There are people who like teaching, who like communicating, who like helping new students, and there are people who want to do their own thing. And that's the reality. Now, I don't know, does he go pester the postdoc?
Yeah, so I think the thing that's important for Bill and important for anybody doing a lab rotation is it's really important to realize that in some ways this is a two-month job interview, or however long your rotation is. So just because you do a rotation in a lab does not mean you're going to be offered the chance to come back to that lab, right? It's sort of a two-way thing. It's like interviewing for grad school in some ways. You're sizing them up. They're sizing you up, right? And so that's your time to make a good impression so that you are somebody they want in the lab. But also it's your chance to do your due diligence and see, is this somewhere that I can thrive, that I can be comfortable and productive over the next 5 or so years to get my PhD?
Yeah, it's a little bit like dating, right? You're trying to impress them, but you're also trying to decide, are they going to work for me?
Yeah, it's a lot like dating. And so in this situation, I think there's a couple things Bill needs to think about. And the first thing is that Bill can't let the actions of this postdoc stand in the way of him getting what he needs. And so the worst thing Bill could do would be to just sort of shut down or hold back or allow his progress to be completely impeded because this other person is not giving him what he needs, not giving him the support he needs.
Bill, I can say I tried that, and it just, I mean, it didn't end poorly, but I didn't go to that lab either.
Yeah, I mean, it would be very frustrating.
I didn't advocate for myself. I didn't go to anybody to say anything. I just lost a lot of time, and by the time I got to the part of the training I needed, the rotation was almost over.
Yeah, one thing I can say, so Bill said he's in a fairly well-known lab, so that would lead me to believe that this is probably a larger lab. There are probably people besides that postdoc who are available. And so one thing I think that's always a good thing to do in any work environment, but especially a new lab environment, is to really identify who are the people that are helpful.
Yeah, who is nurturing, basically.
Yeah, who is willing to show you what you need, who's willing to take the time to be a teacher, to really educate you on what's going on, and actually likes doing that and is gifted in doing that, because I guarantee any lab environment, there probably is someone like that. It's just a matter of figuring out who that person is.
I think that's right. And I have no hard feelings toward the postdoc that I had this experience with either. I mean, I'm not the nurturing type. I want to work on my project and kind of be left alone with it. And I know other people are like that.
Yeah, I mean, maybe what Bill needs to do is come up with some basic technical question and then go and ask every person in the lab that question and see who gives you the best answer, right?
Yeah, or other people on the floor. I mean, I had great relationships with people around the department. Other people are doing the techniques you need to know.
No, that's true. That's true. So first piece of advice, Bill, is don't be limited to just the postdoc you were assigned to. Seek out other people who are helpful to you in the lab. But then the other piece, if really you are doing a project that is directly tied to what this postdoc's doing and you need this postdoc to help you make the progress you need, at some point you have to advocate for yourself and what you need. And so you should feel comfortable and okay with, when you have a meeting with your PI, really just expressing, you know, some of these issues you're having, that, you know, you would like to be doing more, you'd like to be more engaged, but, you know, you're having a hard time getting what you need from the postdoc. And I think you can do that in a very political way, where you don't just throw the postdoc under the bus.
No, it's not tattling, like, oh, I'm not getting what I want.
You know, I think maybe it is. I don't know. But
no, I don't think it I'm playing devil's advocate. I don't think it has to be. But the reality is you're there for your training. And if you decide in the first 2 weeks this is not the lab for you and it's not going to work out, maybe you decide it's not worth the effort to go to that level. But if the lab seems cool, if they're doing good work and you see opportunity, I mean, you'd be crazy not to give it a shot.
Yeah, that's true. And another thing that this made me think about was, you mentioned it's a well-known lab. The PI isn't around much either. And so I could see how this could be a frustrating situation for Bill. The PI is not around much. The postdoc he's been assigned to is not around much. And so one thing I would want to make sure for anybody in any lab is you should feel like, as a trainee, whether you're a grad student, a postdoc, whatever, that you have set FaceTime one-on-one with your PI. And so even if it's an established PI, even if it's a well-known PI who's traveling around giving talks or whatever, the best mentors, whether they're established or not, make time to be a mentor and to sit down face-to-face, one-on-one with you. And I would say weekly on average.
Do you need a Google Calendar for that, or do you just see them in the hallway and say two things?
No, I think this needs to be on the schedule. Tuesdays at 10 o'clock are my time to meet with the PI. You need to be prepared for that meeting, especially if you know the PI's time is limited. But, you know, if that's something that you find is not a request that can be met, then maybe as a rotation student, that's something you need to file away, that maybe this is not, as a trainee, the place where I'm going to get the support I need to learn how to be a scientist.
Okay, well, we'll have to hear back from Bill about whether he tried any of these things and what the result was. Let's move on to the next question. So this is Sandra. She writes, I'm looking for industry jobs, and I found one that sounds interesting at a local biotech company. I applied using their online portal, but I'm wondering if there's something else I can do to improve my chances of getting an interview. That's a fantastic question.
That's a great job. So I always thought those online portals for industry jobs, those go straight to outer space.
I think
is that true?
They go to outer space via a printer that feeds into a shredder.
Yeah, there has to be paper involved, I would think.
And then they get launched.
It's a dot matrix printer.
Yeah, it's very slow. The way that it gets through the printer, it has to be very slow.
Yeah, so does anybody actually get a job through applying online through some web portal?
In most businesses, I would say no. So it's something like 90 or 95% of jobs that people get are never advertised, which should blow your mind. And at the same time, something like 70% of people are applying for the jobs that are posted. So the reality is, if you are looking for an industry job, you should be doing almost everything but applying online for that job.
So would you say you are actually wasting your time?
No, you're not wasting your time. You've got to jump through the hoop, but you also have to be doing a lot of other things to line yourself up as the obvious candidate for that position. It's just a fact of human nature that people hire people they like. So I know it sounds sleazy and it sounds weird and scientists hate the idea of networking.
Oh no, he didn't.
And don't call it that. Call it meeting people and making friends.
My hair is standing up on my arms at the mention of the networking.
I apologize. I said the word. I don't like the word either.
You know, scientists, I don't know what the stats are. We are, in general, a group of introverts. So networking seems scary to me.
Great. Be an introvert. Don't go to these like meat market, you know, meet and greets. I've been to them. I looked for a lot of jobs in biotech companies and in industry jobs. And you go to these, everybody wears a name tag, and it's 15 people around your same stage of development. Nobody has jobs to offer, but you're all there looking for jobs. It's really a nightmare. I agree a networking social is a bad idea. But if you have a company that you know you're interested in and a position you know you're interested in, see if there's any way you can find out about a person you know through someone who works there. So LinkedIn is great. I don't know if everybody has a LinkedIn account. I think most people probably do.
I think it's pretty common now.
It seems like it should be. See if you can get introduced. And what you want to do is set up an informational interview, which just means rule number one of an informational interview: do not ask for a job. That is the death of an informational interview. You find the person you need to talk to. You say, I'd like to do an informational interview. And that just means I'm going to go ask you about the company. And I'm going to ask you about the position. And I'm going to ask you about the culture of the work that you do. And I'm going to ask you about people who do this type of work. You're there to make an impression and to make a friend. And you won't get that position, but you'll get the one five after that position. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I've actually heard it said by meeting people this way, you want to be the person that they have in mind when a job opening comes up. They think, oh, you know what? I met that Dan guy several months back, and he seemed like he was really interested in this type of thing.
That's right. I met so many people as I was job searching kind of outside of the lab career space. I met so many people that have nothing to do with what I ended up doing, but they're interesting people. They're doing interesting work, and I can count them as friends, a lot of them now. But the reality is, one out of 100 of those meetings you go to will lead to an actual position, but that one position will be such a great fit for you, because you've now got, instead of you looking for a job on 10 career sites, you've got 100 people keeping their eyes open for you, looking for jobs for you. It's awesome.
That's great advice. And something else that came to mind for me that is a real benefit of these informational interviews is not just priming the pump for possibly getting a job someday, but also is just a way to find out from people, is this the type of job that I might really want? Because once, as we said before, as a science trainee, you are somewhat insulated. You're around a lot of people who do academic science, and so you may think industry sounds cool, but you may not have a great impression about what is that lifestyle like? What's the day-to-day like? And those informational interviews are not only good from a networking perspective, but they're also good just from a self-reflection perspective of gathering information to see, is this a good fit? Is this career a good fit for who I am?
No, it's a really good point. I remember meeting up with a guy who worked at a local biotech company. And I said, let me buy you coffee. We'll go to Barnes & Noble. And we sat there, and he started telling me about what he did. And super nice guy, really enjoyed talking to him. But as he described the work, I was just like, ugh, you know I don't want this. But you don't cut off the conversation, because the reality is you might not like it, but your friend might like it, and you'll know about it, and you'll be able to introduce them. I really think it's a value to have these connections so that you can help use them for other people that need them.
Absolutely. And figuring out what you don't want to do is worth the price of a cup of coffee.
It seems like it. Coffee's good anyway. Or go get a Dale's Pale Ale together.
There you go. So this is the second episode in a row we've talked about informational interviews, so I'm thinking that's probably a good thing to have in your toolbox.
Yeah, definitely put it in your toolbox. And remember rule number one, do not ask for a job.
There you have it.
Okay. Are you ready for the etymology of the week?
The etymology of the week, the word of the week. Is this a science word this week?
It's actually a science word. You didn't like last week's?
I loved last week. Non-science word? I loved it. Okay. What do you have for us this week?
Okay. This week's science word is autoclave.
Autoclave. I have spent a lot of quality time with an autoclave as my background as a microbiologist.
I think the those little pellets that they put with the waste autoclaving should be considered some kind of biological weapon.
Mm.
I don't know. Did you have good ones? They were really gross to me.
The little water bath.
The pellets that you put in with the garbage waste that are supposed to make it smell better.
Oh, we didn't have that.
I'm sorry.
What kind of ivory tower
Ooh,
were la, you la. Autoclaving with?
Ooh, no, la, la. The we Kentucky didn't, autoclaves had really nice
We didn't have such niceties where I came from. So the autoclave, let me see. You're the word guy. I'm not, but auto, that means self.
That's self. You got the first part, and that comes from Greek.
Okay, so we're self-claving.
Claving.
Claving.
It's tough. It's a really tough one. It's not a word you get.
Help me out on that.
So you're forgiven for not picking up on the Latin second half of the Greek first half.
I try not to mix my Greek and Latin.
Well, you shouldn't. So the second half is clavis, key. Anything from that? Self key?
Self.
It's a pretty bizarre key thing to call something that sterilizes things. Like, why not call it a steam box or a sterilizer or something like that?
That's true.
So the place it comes from is because when it goes under pressure, it locks itself.
That's true. There's an audible, you can see the door.
It pressurizes, the steam seals.
Self-lock.
Self-lock. What a bizarre thing to call.
No, really, no reference to the sterilization part at all.
Not at all. I mean, it's under pressure, which is, I guess, part of the process. Invented in 1879 by Charles Chamberlain.
Interesting. So what was the original use of the autoclave? Was it for research purposes or was there some other functional use? Do you know?
I have no idea, although I think this was around the time when they discovered, germs and started to understand that things needed to be sterile and not just wiped on their aprons. So there you have it. This is why I like word origins, because who thinks about this stuff? You're in lab, you throw it in the autoclave, you push the button, you try and get out to make sure that it doesn't overpressurize and blow up.
So go out there this week in the lab, tell your friends and colleagues why the autoclave is called the autoclave, and when they ask you where you heard that, you can say, "Hello, PhD podcast."
That's exactly right.
Well, I think that is all we have for this week. Hope you guys have enjoyed the show. Again, we would love to hear from you, whether you have comments on what we've talked about today, ideas for a new show, or if you have questions that you'd like for us to talk about here on the podcast, we would love to hear them. You can tweet at us at HelloPhD or shoot us an email, podcast@HelloPhD.com.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.